JJ's just waiting to the last second to sit down, aren't you? All right, we're on number 3. In the idolatry seminar, a.k.a. Inside Out Transformation. An idol can be a relationship, a physical object, a person, an activity, a role, an institution, a hope, an idea, a pleasure, a hero. Anything can substitute for God. I just stopped the list there because I just was going to run out of paper. You can just keep adding anything to the list. My youngest daughter attended the School of World Missions last year, and just prior to leaving the States to come here, she was in a car accident. She was at a red light. Actually, it had turned a stoplight. It was green. She was trying to turn left. It was green, but she didn't have a green arrow. And as I found out later, she was on the cell phone talking to her boyfriend, which she was embarrassed to confess. And she turned left, which you can do, of course, as long as there's no cars coming. But of course, she was focusing more on the cell phone and her boyfriend, and a car hit her. Now, it makes it her fault, of course. So she calls me. She's in downtown Nashville, and she's in tears. She doesn't have her license either. She's left the house. I don't know if that matters here, but that's a pretty serious issue. So she's waiting for the police, and she's hit this guy's car as a mess. And so I get in the car, and it's about a 30-minute ride, and I get downtown. It takes a while for the police to come. So I meet the guy she's hit, or he's hit her. It's her fault. And he's a classic. You know, Nashville is a music town, okay? I don't know if you're familiar with that, but everybody in Nashville, if they weren't born there, which hardly anybody was, they came primarily for music at some level. That's why worship bands in Nashville churches are astronomically good. I mean, even the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th string deep, you still have professionals. So it's just a music town. And there's a lot of people who are just old, burned out hippies that somehow they missed the news that the 60s are over and they passed. Well, this guy, he was just an old redneck hippie, not too much younger than me, but long hair, but you know, balding, but long hair, you know, which to me is disgusting, but it's my own personal opinion. So typical Tennessee redneck guy. So I sit and talk to him. He's got this gorgeous 2008 cherry red classic Mustang. I mean, it is just beautiful. And I don't even care about cars, but I'm even impressed. So I'm talking with him, you know, because his Mustang. So that's actually his 12th Mustang he's had in his life. And so he begins telling me all about his Mustangs. And you can tell this guy is known as the Mustang guy. And that's how his friends know him. That's what gives him his sense of identity. I realize it doesn't take long because, you know, a person they'll reveal their idols pretty quickly if you just let them talk. It was pretty obvious what this guy's idol was. It was his Mustang. And, you know, of course, my daughter destroyed his idol, but he was handling pretty good, fortunately. I thought, you know, there's a lot of things you can go to hell for, but a Mustang just doesn't seem worth it to me. It was so startling to think that something I mean, I guess it's a nice car and everything, but that could become something that your whole life really revolves around. That's your identity. Without your Mustang, you're nothing. You don't have any sense of self, who I am. I'm known through that. Anything. Relationships, I put that number one because that's probably the ultimate idol. And I think it goes back to the Garden of Eden and the whole nature of who we are and the triune God. But you think about, where would pop music be without idolatry? When you start thinking now in terms of idolatry, you realize that those songs that you liked, as you start listening to them, it's really just idolatry with a beat, just with a nice melody. I can't live without you. You are my everything. I need you. I mean, just go down the line of all the lyrics, and you can hear idolatry. If that person loves me, then everything's okay with me. Life is fine. But if that person rejects me, then what do I have to live for? You know, if you lose an important thing, something that's important to you, it hurts. But if you lose an ultimate thing, you feel like you don't even want to live anymore. If you lose an important thing, something that's important to you, it's painful, it hurts. Certainly, rightfully so. But if you lose an ultimate thing, something that has become the replacement for God, when you lose that, then you feel like you don't even want to live. You wonder why people lose a job and commit suicide. That seems pretty extreme. But you understand, that was their whole source of their identity. And now it's gone. They've lost an ultimate thing. Life isn't worth living. I was thinking about the University of America, the University of Virginia, UVA is a real top, high-level university, very demanding standards. And they had a high rate of suicide around exam times. And you think, you know, why would a student kill himself because he fails an exam? Well, see, it goes back to idolatry. You know, if doing well in school is important to you and you fail, it hurts. It's painful. I mean, you know. But if it's an ultimate thing, then you feel like you can't go on. It's interesting what they did at the University of Virginia to solve their problem. This is a little side note, but have you ever seen the movie It's a Wonderful Life? Yeah. It's a tradition now. It plays on campus 24 hours a day during exam times. And it cut the suicide rate dramatically. So people go and say, okay, Frank Capra, help me. I'm going to make it. Well, you know, whatever works, obviously. It's not a lasting solution, but at least temporarily it helps. You can go through this whole list here. Parents can become idols, right? Family expectations. That's probably even more of a bigger stronghold in the Philippines because it's more of a traditional culture than the West, which emphasizes individuality. You're defined in Western culture by what you do as an individual. In more traditional cultures, you're defined by your family. And so family demands, family expectation, family approval, it's a greater issue. And then tends to more idolatry. I think how many people have missed God's call because they didn't want to disappoint their parents? Parental expectations. My family becomes an idol. Even in America, family values, okay, that's an important buzzword in the churches. You know, family values can sometimes be just a sanctified code word for idolatry. I value my family above everything. Now, I'm disguising it as, well, I believe in family values, the importance of the family, and that's a biblical value. Yes, true. 100% true. But is your motivation the glory of God, or is the family an idol to you? Tim Keller said, at the root of all our problems, personal or social, and all non-Christian ideologies, is the elevation of some created thing to the place of ultimate worship and the ultimate arbiter of truth and meaning. Let's look at the prevalence of idolatry in the Bible. Many Christian thinkers have seen idolatry as the most pervasive sin in the Scriptures. Pervasive. P-E-R-V-A-S-I-V-E. The most pervasive sin in the Scriptures. Go back to the 3rd century church father, Tertullian, said the principal crime of the human race, the highest guilt charged upon the world, the whole procuring cause of judgment is idolatry. Some more recent authors, the whole Bible is written as a full-scale assault on idolatry. Idolatry is the most discussed problem in the Bible. So just a quick scan of Scripture. Adam and Eve's treason was ultimately idolatry. It was the exchange of the worship of God for the promise of knowledge. It's desirable to make you wise. It looked good to the eyes. It was good to eat. It was a trade. It was idolatry. Man was created to serve God and rule over all creation. When he traded God for created thing came to rule over him. The first of the Ten Commandments forbid idolatry. The first of the Ten Commandments forbid idolatry. You shall have no other gods before me. Martin Luther wrote a lot about the first commandment, and he said something I think is very profound. He said, the first commandment is the first commandment because it's the first commandment. Let me say that again. I know that was so deep. The first commandment is the first commandment because it's the first commandment. What he meant by that is you never break any of the other nine if you haven't first already broken the first. Actually, the breaking of any of the others just evidences that you've already broken the first. There's something that is, at least at the moment of sin, is more important to you than God, which is the essence of the first commandment. So, for example, lying, okay? You know, that's one of the commandments, right? You all know that, right? Thou shalt not lie, right? So, do you ever break that commandment? Charles, do you ever lie? There were times, okay? I'm going to give you one more chance to answer this question honestly. Charles, do you ever lie? Yes, you do, of course. Yeah, we all lie. Why do we lie? We know it's wrong, right? We know it's wrong, right? Yes. Everybody with me? Why do we lie? When I say lie, I know we like to say, well, we kind of stretch the truth. Or we just exaggerate, or we withheld some of the details. Right? We got little terms for it to make us feel better. But when you get right down to it, it's lying. Why do we lie? Well, of course, the ultimate answer is we lie because we're sinners. All right? Sinners lie. We're sinners. We lie. But why do you lie in some situations and you don't lie in others? For example, I lie. Now, I'm going to be tempted to lie in these situations when telling you the truth is going to severely inconvenience me. I'm going to be tempted. And sometimes, I'm sad to say, I will succumb to the temptation and lie. Now, I'll do it in a way that I don't feel as bad about my sin, but I have lied. Now, why do I lie in those situations? You see, it's because I've already broken the first commandment, because one of the big issues of idolatry in my life is control. I want control. And when helping you or answering you a particular way is going to cause me to lose control and inconvenience me, there's a pressure that sometimes causes me to lie. Now, my wife's not here, but if she was here, of course, she's a lot holier than I am, and it's a much rarer occasion for her. But she will never lie if telling the truth will inconvenience her. I mean, in 32 years of marriage, she just doesn't do that. She's not even tempted to lie in situations like that. However, I have noticed she might be tempted to lie if telling the truth is going to hurt someone's feelings. She might be tempted then, you see, and may occasionally succumb. You see, I never lie. I'm just not even tempted to lie when telling the truth might hurt someone's feelings. I just don't even feel the temptation. I just won't lie then. I'm not even tempted. See, it's a different set of idols. It's a different violation of the first commandment. When I sin in lying at that moment, it's because I've already broken that first commandment. There's something at that moment, not ultimately, but at that moment that's more important to me than God, and that's all my own control of my life and situation. Does that make sense to you? Is that clear? So, that's why the first commandment is the first commandment, because it's the first commandment. When you broke any other, you got to find out there's something about the first commandment. There's an idol behind every sin. We're going to see that as we progress. And we can take all the commandments and just look, go down through them. The Israelites, we're just following through the scriptures, were continually straying into idolatry. It's just the continual course of the old covenant. The word idol, idols, idolatry is used 118 times by the Hebrew prophets. I know, I counted them. Isaiah through Malachi. So idolatry is a constant recurring theme. Number five, idolatry looks different in the New Testament, but it's just as pervasive. Just as pervasive. It's common to associate idolatry with the Old Testament and disassociate it with the New Testament. But although it manifests in different forms, it's just as prevalent. David Paulson says, if idolatry is the characteristic and summary Old Testament word for our drift from God, then lust, the Greek word is epithymia, is the characteristic and summary New Testament word for the same drift. Now, this Greek word is interesting, and you know, of course, all of you are bilingual, so you understand this concept that nuances of meaning, it's difficult to translate from one language to another. Sometimes when I sit in the staff meetings and someone makes a joke, nobody jokes in English. I don't know why. Filipinos can't be funny in English. I don't. They can only be funny in Tagalog. So all the good stuff, you know, is always in Tagalog. And someone tries to explain it to me, and that wasn't very funny. But it's just lost, right? So there's just nuances. And that's always the difficulty of translation. So when our translators are trying to find a single word translation for the Greek, all translation, you understand, is commentary. You know, they're making comment. There's no parallel exact translation. So they're making decisions, they're making choices, and good choices, the best choices available by and large, but they can't capture everything. And so we see this word epithemia translated lust often. And so we've got connotations in our mind, lust. When you hear the word, primarily, first of all, it has a sexual connotation, generally. Then you might think about it when it comes to food and maybe a few other things. But it comes from a much more complex, multidimensional Greek word, epithemia. The word themia just means desire. And it can be a good desire or a bad desire. And the prefix epi is a prefix that always intensifies whatever word it's associated with. So epithemia, the best way to describe it is it's an over-desire. An over-desire. Or an excessive desire for something that may or may not be inherently bad, which is exactly what idolatry is. So we talked about relationship, okay? So relationship between the opposite sex. Is having a relationship with a man or a woman, is that inherently wrong? No, that's a good desire God put in every human being, right? It only becomes an idol when it becomes an excessive, an over-desire, you see, when it takes the place of God. So when you see the word lust, don't think what your mind automatically thinks. Think over-desire, something that's not inherently wrong. A Mustang is not inherently evil, right? It's a blessing from God. It only becomes a sinful desire when it takes the place, when it provides something for you emotionally, psychologically, that only God can. It becomes then an epithemia, a lust, an over desire. And so the word idolatry is the New Old Testament word. Epithemia is the New Testament word. But it's the same human issue that's being referred to. Do you see that? So even though idolatry as a word doesn't show up in the New Testament a lot, its companion concept, epithemia, shows up everywhere. But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh or the natural man. Our first subpoint here, John concludes his epistle with a blanket statement against idolatry. I can still remember, I've been a Christian almost 35 years, but I can still remember the first time as a young believer reading 1 John and really liking it and getting to the last verse and feeling so deeply disappointed. Because it ends, this verse right here, this is the end of the book. Dear children, keep yourself from idols. You can't end that way. It's like you just cut, there's got to be more, right? What does that mean? This is a really unusual statement to end with. The amazing thing is, through all five chapters, John has not even mentioned the word idolatry. And all of a sudden, his last thing, oh, by the way, kids, keep yourself from idols. Talk more about that. Now, there's only two ways to understand this. Either John is just changing the whole subject of everything that he's been talking about at the last minute and just ran out of ink. Or this last statement is a summary statement of everything he's been talking about for five chapters about living in the light and walking in love and the truth. I think that's a much more likely possibility, you see. So idolatry becomes a summary statement. If you walk in love and the truth, you'll keep yourself from idols. He's essentially putting in the negative what he's put in the positive for five chapters. So we could assume then any failure to walk in holiness is some form of idolatry. I think that's a legitimate conclusion. Especially when we see Paul. Paul lists a number of particular sins and then connects all temptation with idolatry. Notice 1 Corinthians 10. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. We've all used this verse before, haven't we? It's a pretty popular one. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, He will provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. Now, unfortunately, most of our preaching and most of our Bible study is just grabbing Bible verses out of their context, and we don't read the very next verse, which actually has a connector term, therefore, which means whatever is coming, about to come, is deeply connected with what has already happened. Therefore, my friends, flee from idolatry. The conclusion that we get from just simply looking at the text is whenever we are tempted, there is some form of idolatry behind it. Therefore, we could take it to the next step. To avoid temptation, we must determine what idol is at the root. This produces lasting change. See, I think some of our frustration, I know for me, some of my frustration is I didn't go deep enough in assessing what the real issue I was dealing with was. I dealt with it as the external temptation, whatever it might be, and tried real hard to stop doing that particular thing. Now, I'm a pretty highly motivated individual, strong willpower. I make decisions generally just a part of my natural makeup, and I follow through. That's just the way I am. So because of that, I was able to get over a lot of things. But you see, that's just soul power. Do you know, people without Christ change all the time. Right? You understand that. Matter of fact, any rock and roll star that I listened to as a kid who is still alive today has undergone major behavioral transformation. Otherwise, they'd be dead. A lot of them are. Dramatic transformational change, all apart from Christ. There's a long way that determination and willpower can go to affect change in a person's life. But God is so faithful to us. There's always issues that we cannot, no matter how hard we try, get over. We just can't seem to win that particular battle. And that's God's grace to us, to force us to get back to the real root of what our need is and our problem is. So behavioral change is not lasting. It doesn't change the heart, you see. We're going to talk more about how we actually put this into practice. But because I have context as my number one theme, I've got to give you way more information that you probably care about. But I have the microphone, so we're going to learn a little bit more before we actually start getting down to how we're going to find out what our particular idols are and get to the root of them. The results of idolatry. I like Otto the way he put it, the unholy trinity, right? All idolatry ultimately is self-worship. It's all worship of self, ultimately. And there are consequences to worshiping ourselves. Here's a few of them. Number one, idols blind the heart and mind. They blind the heart and mind. I won't read this whole text from Isaiah, but I put it there for your reading enjoyment later. It's pretty fascinating. So the Lord's talking to this guy who's an idolater, and he says, now wait a minute. He says, so you get one log. So imagine the guy's got this big log, and you bring the log home. Okay, you cut the log in half. Half of the log you put in the fire, and you use it to cook your food, and then you eat your food. The other half you take and you carve an idol out of it, and then you bow down and worship it. Hello? The same wood you burned just to cook your food, you made a god out of and you worship. He's ridiculing and mocking idolatry, but he's also showing us that idolatry makes you stupid. It blinds the heart. It deceives a heart, your heart, so you can't see how foolish you are. See, that's the interesting thing. It's so easy to pick out somebody else's idols. You can see how foolish they are. Very easy to see a 2008 Mustang. What a foolish idol. It's easy to see how foolish another person's idols are. It's hard to see how foolish your own are. Because idolatry, by its very nature, it blinds your heart and your mind. You can't see the effect it's having upon you. Idols, number two, create false definitions of success, failure, happiness, sadness, value, worthlessness. False definitions. I'm going to concentrate on this one because I think it's especially pertinent for people who, by career and calling, do what you do. Because what you do is very much oriented on tangible results. Tangible results. Measurable results. And so, false definitions of what is success, what is happiness, what is real value, can really haunt people, especially in the particular field that you're in. Do you know what I mean by false definitions? Idols create a definition of what success should look like and that you have to measure up to. See? And so those idols, then they produce deep issues of drivenness to accomplish, to somehow measure up to this definition of success. And often because there's issues you want to, because you're Christians, you want to please God and you want to make your pastor happy. But probably everybody at some time has dealt with a little epithemia when it comes to pastoral approval. So you really want approval, and this drivenness can really push you because there's a false definition about what success is. Success is if I get this project done this way in this particular time. The best illustration maybe can help you. I was pastoring a church, this was years ago, late 80s, and there was a girl who was on staff. She was a campus minister. She had come from another one of our churches, where the ministry had failed there, and actually we had closed it down, shut it down, and she had moved to be in my church. And so she was dealing with a lot of issues of failure because the ministry had failed. She'd been the leading female campus minister there. And, you know, I mean, rightfully so, she would have some feelings of failure that you have to deal with. But it was an epithemia for this particular girl, and she couldn't seem to get over it. And I remember talking to her one time, and she finally told me what was really going on in her heart. She said, "I don't believe God can forgive me for that failure. I don't believe God can forgive me." So, of course, I went through all the Bible verses about forgiveness, like a good pastor, right? And showed her what the Bible says. And she would look at all the verses. "Yes, I believe those verses are true, but not for me. I don't believe God will forgive me. My sin, my failure is too great." So I did my best to try to convince her she was wrong. I never did. She left. I haven't heard from her. I don't know how many years that is. But I often think, or recently think, I wish I could have had that meeting again, because I would have told her something totally different. I actually would have agreed with her. Said, "Your God will not forgive you, because your God is an idol that's created a false definition of success. And you can never fully please an idol. You can never satisfy. You'll never live up to that definition of success." So I should have agreed with her and said, "You're right, God won't forgive you. Your God. Now, the God of the Bible will. The question is, do you want to trade your God for the God of the Bible?" Well, unfortunately, I didn't know that, so I didn't have a chance to tell her that. But I think it happens with so many people. Depression, feelings of failure, and then being driven to work harder, staying up crazy hours, not taking days off, doing this for long periods of time, this sense of drivenness. Is it because you're really dedicated? I'm sure you are. But I wonder, is there something else? Is there a false definition that's driving you? If you can't take a day off, and I mean really take a day off, there's probably some issues of idolatry below the surface. One thing, in 32 years of ministry, I've just never missed a day off. I think partly because I'm constitutionally lazy, so it kind of works for me. I don't know if it's anything that noble, but it's the ability to leave work with projects unfinished is a theological issue. Is your trust in God, or does it really depend on you? Is there an idol that's pushing you, some kind of expectation? I mean, there's all kinds of them. Sometimes parental expectations or parental, you'll never amount, you'll never be this, you'll never be like your brother, you'll never do this. And there's an idol there, a drive to, "Oh yeah, I'll prove to you I will." That drives you. Why can't you just go home? Why can't you leave a project unfinished? You've worked 60 hours this week. Isn't that enough? Why can't you just look at your pastor and say, "I did not finish it. I did not have the time. I'm sorry. But God loves me." God loves me. And I have His approval. I went home. See, sometimes anxiety haunts me, okay? I'm trying to go to bed at night. I'm trying to sleep, and I'm haunted by things that I haven't done. And I realize this is an issue, this is a theological issue. And I have a choice to dishonor God or to honor God. I honor God by going to sleep. I dishonor God by being anxious about all my unfinished projects. Because ultimately, I'm the Savior. If I don't get it done, who's going to do it? See, that's a theological issue. That's a question of idolatry. So and believe me, I'm still struggling, okay? So I don't want you to think I'm the ultimate paragon of faith when it comes to these issues. But at least I know why I'm sinning when I sin. And I make it a decision, I make a declaration. Lord, I want to honor you by going to sleep. You give your beloved sleep. And I am going to deliberately check out, go home, not finish this project to honor you and to break these idols of false definitions that drive me in my life. Are y'all with me? How you doing? They would, yeah. As they do with most tweets. Like, what does that mean? I don't know. Yeah. Anybody want to say anything? Ask a question? This would be a good time. Something not clear? Okay. I'll keep going. I have a feeling I hit the mark, though. Idols enslave us to these false definitions. There was a guy at our Every Nation office in Nashville, and when I used to teach our ENLI classes, class would start at 6:30, so I would stay, of course, through the evening, and I finally made a commitment to him. If I saw him at the office at 6 o'clock, I would, still there at 6 o'clock, I would forcibly remove him from the building. I would make him, and I did it for his wife. His wife would tell me, he never takes off, he's always working, our family's suffering. So I would force him, actually leave. Of course, in the end, his wife told me later, it didn't do any good, because he'd just bring the work home. So external controls don't deal with internal idols. You got to deal with it at the heart of the matter. Where are we? Discovering idols. You know, I'm gonna take a break here because I don't want to interrupt this next section. So it's 10:48. Give you 12 minutes. We'll start back at 11. Next session back at 11.